We are in the middle, coming to the end of a study through a book called On the Table, which covers some big questions that are difficult to talk about. And the reason we want to try to get better at talking about them is these questions often keep people from exploring Christianity, keep them from exploring faith, keep them from God. They've got notions about the answer to these questions and attitudes about those who hold positions on them, namely Christians. And in many ways, well-meaning oftentimes make it even worse because we don't really know how to talk about it. We're trying to dig in. There's a study Monday night, which is going fabulously well. You're welcome to come to that. It grows a number each week. Just a safe space sort of talk about what we need to talk about and the kind of questions we have. Digging deeper on the message content. And yes, this week we're talking about hell. It's challenging, right? I have not look forward to this. And the only thing that makes this message attractive at all to me is that next week is even harder. So I'm trying to enjoy this one. It's going to be loads of fun. We're gonna just go after it. Let me give you some stats here. There's all sorts of studies about these sorts of things, and they generally land at right about the same place. 72% of, and this is, I think these are Americans in most cases, I'll bet it's not too far from global realities, but 72% of people believe in heaven. 58% of those that were studied believe in hell. Studies also reveal that somewhere between 55 and 65% of Americans expect to go to heaven when they die. What percentage of people do you think anticipate themselves going to hell? How much? 30? Less than one. Less, like somewhere around one. 75% of people think they're going to go to heaven. Less than 1% think they're going to go to hell, which just, it makes sense, right? You just want to live in that world, in that imaginary world that I have a better chance of going to heaven, way better than I do of going to hell. It just is an indication of, in most cases, denial, right? 39% of Americans believe that even those who do not believe in God can go to heaven. Right? What does that tell you? We have a diverse understanding of what the definition of heaven even is, right? That's a non sequitur for a Christian. What do you mean that there's no God, but you could still go to where God lives? It doesn't make sense. Some people believe in eternal life in heaven, but the extinction of the soul instead of hell. In other words, if you're going to live forever, you're going to live in heaven. And if you aren't going to live in heaven, then you're just going to be extinguished. You're going to be annihilated. The list of unanswered questions about hell is very long. Why would how could it be possibly true that a kind and good person would go to hell? Is hell cold or is it on fire? Can it be both? Will heaven be elsewhere or will it be right here on a redeemed earth? How can a redemptive-hearted God entirely give up on a majority of humanity? Right? The eternal permanence of hell suggests no second chances from a God of second chances, right? These questions that we could go on and on. You have your own. What's it like? This week I looked through a book about hell with four different compelling, biblically grounded views, all different. The simplest question of all, does hell exist, isn't answered even uniformly by the historic Christian community. One thing that is common is that the topic itself is very uncomfortable. Show of hands on that, right? It's just uncomfortable. We don't like it one way or the other. We all agree on that. So maybe it's 100%. But followers of Jesus are faced with a very uncomfortable fact that he spoke of hell more than all of the other biblical authors put together. We need to get a grip on this as best we can. And we can. Hell is actually quite reasonable. It's actually pretty understandable. I think we complicate it and convolute it because the simplicity of it is too haunting. Does that make sense? The simplicity of hell as eternal punishment. When we look at the mirror and compare ourselves to the holiness of God, think, well, let's complicate this a little bit, make it a little bit obscure. You know, it's like, it just makes sense. The surprising news, though, I do want to encourage you with this. I can tell you where I'm going to end. I'm going to end in a space that'll be very, very encouraging to you. I know that for a fact. It will be very, very encouraging to you. Because hell, surprisingly, if I let you peek into the gift box, ultimately provides a sense of stability and peace and courage. And that shouldn't make any sense to you right out of the blocks, but it hopefully will in a minute. So all right, let's have some fun. Let's look at hell. Okay, let's do it. So I researched a bunch this week, prayed, reflected, listened, had conversations, mined through my own soul, and began to wonder if you can't actually get a good understanding of hell by staring directly at it. Like if you just put it out there and say, well, let's talk about it, let's describe it, let's figure it out. And I started thinking about all the things that are, maybe you could even say, closely associated with hell. And as I thought about those things, the picture of hell started to become a little bit clearer. So I want to suggest that we don't look directly at it. But which, by the way, do you know that when it's dark, your peripheral vision is actually better than your straight-on vision? Did you know that? You learn that if you're a pilot, because when you fly at night in the dark, it's better to not look at what you want to see, but allow it. You should try it. In the dark sometime when you're looking around, look at things, which is hard to do. Look at something out of your peripheral. It becomes, actually, it's much clearer. That's just meaningless information I thought I would give you. I could go on about why. I'm not going to do that to you. What we're going to do today is we're not going to look directly at hell. We're going to look at the things in the periphery of hell and try to make some sense of it. I considered five things. There's lots of things you look at. There's five things that we want to look at with our peripheral vision that might help. The gospel. Jesus' description. Heaven as an inheritance. Paul's warnings. Life and life as a microcosm, which of eternity. So I'm going to look at the gospel, Jesus' description, heaven is inheritance, Paul's warning, life is a microcosm. And I don't, as well, I'm worried about complicating it myself. It's kind of challenging. Right? I think it's not that complicated. Don't complicate it in you're trying to describe that it's not complicated. So if I have the courage, this shouldn't really take that long. The gospel. I hope you know the gospel, the good news. The old news held that only an elite, perfect few could find and navigate the heaven-bound path of life while everyone else was doomed. That was the old news. The old news was only a few could find their way through strict obedience. That was the old news. Everyone else was doomed. The good news that Jesus declared was universal access to the, catch this, previously inaccessible heaven-bound path of life, right? The good news was nobody's on this path apart from Jesus. So the old news was completely wrong. He shocked the audience that he was talking to with the revelation that nobody apart from him was on the heaven-bound path of life. In fact, that everyone was trapped on a hell-bound road. That was very uncomfortable, good news for the elite few. Wonderful news for the rest of us. That everyone has a faith option in Jesus to be on the heaven-bound path. Maybe one of the best texts for this is in Ephesians chapter 2 when Paul's writing to this young church. He says, as for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins. You had the same capacity as a corpse to do anything about your future. You're dead in your transgressions, in which you used to live when you followed the ways of this world. I'm paraphrasing a little bit here. All of us who lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our flesh and following its desires and thoughts. Like the rest, we, who thought were the elite few, we all were by nature deserving of wrath. But because of his great love for us, God, who is rich in mercy, made us alive with Christ even when we were dead in transgressions. That is the good news. Nobody's on the heaven-bound path of life apart from Jesus. Nobody. But everybody has opportunity. That wasn't true in their view back in the day. Jesus introduced himself as the long-awaited good news to a destruction-bound humanity. He introduced himself as a faith-based freedom to join him on the path of flourishing and to heaven, as opposed to destruction. That's the gospel. That's the first thing. In our peripheral vision, as we consider hell, we see among the innumerable geographies and varieties of life only two sorts of people. In your peripheral vision, as we're thinking about hell, you imagine only two sorts of people: those using a faith-given freedom to follow the narrow path toward heaven, and those opting for the wide path in the opposite direction. There's only two kinds of people among all the various kinds of people. You understand what I'm saying? In your peripheral vision, you see two paths, two groups of people on those paths. One by faith toward heaven, the other not. Okay, that's first, gospel. The next, Jesus talked about hell in graphic terms, right? He called it eternal fire and punishment. Matthew 25, outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. Matthew 8 and 22 and 25. The final resting place of angels and human beings. Shouldn't say resting place, that's a paraphrase on my part, that's not good. The final abode is what it says, the final home of the angels and human beings who have rejected God. Again, in Matthew 25. Here in Mark 9, the fire of hell for those who give in to sin. Jesus would refer to this valley called Gehenna when he was referring to hell. He would point to this place in which, get this, I'm telling you, this is graphic, and piles of garbage were daily burned as well as corpses of those without families who could bury them. And he would supplement that already graphic description and say, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. In Gehenna, once the bodies were gone, the maggots would die and the refuse, fire would go out. Not so with regard to hell. Jesus referring to maggots that live in the corpses and the garbage that die. But spiritual decomposition is what he means to say never ends. It's horrible. It's a horrible idea. He says, you look at that dump and eventually that fire goes out and the maggots all dry when all the trash is gone. But the eternal Gehenna, the fire stays and the maggots stay and the spiritual destruction and the decay continues. In light of that, in Matthew chapter 10, Jesus says, don't fear those who can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul, and body in hell. And he's talking to his disciples who are all going to, in many cases, die some horrific deaths. And he's saying, that's a picnic. Your earthly demise is a picnic compared to hell. I warned you, Jesus is graphically describing a godless eternal reality by pointing to a human garbage dump of death and disease and decay. And he does it out of deep compassion to shock the audience out of its stupor and its arrogant posture that their self-orientation and their self-confidence has consequences. So, in our metaphorical peripheral vision, we see, imagine this, people on one of two paths, and Jesus waving his arms and pointing to a very, very bad future for those on the wrong path. That's what we see. Maybe this is a side note. You can't say that you trust Jesus only for what doesn't interrupt your personal sensibilities. Either he was true and truthful and right and good and God, and what he says is true, or he wasn't. You can't pick and choose. And he talked a lot about hell and the devastating reality of it. Three. Heaven as an inheritance. This is a rather simple point. I mean, you can see in more than even the examples that I have here, but for example, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus describes those who inherit the kingdom of God. In Matthew 19, the rich young man, Jesus tells to enter the kingdom of heaven, he must sell his possessions and give to the poor, and highlighting the difficulty to inherit the earth. In the parable of the Good Samaritan, the lawyer asked how do I inherit eternal life? And Jesus responds with a parable. Heaven is an eventuality that is inherited. What does it mean to be inherited, to inherit something? It is a future reality. When you're going to inherit something, you own it in advance of having it. It is a future reality based on who you are now. Are you with me? An inheritance, you get an inheritance based on who you are now. You don't get it till later, but you're getting it later because of who you are. So add this to your periphery. Heaven is an eventuality that is inherited. A future reality based on who you are. So here's it. It's your peripheral vision. You have people on two different paths. This path of going to destruction. Jesus is waving his arms compassionately, emphatically, pointing at a very bad future. And then we see a pathway with a very clear and reasonable future based on what is happening now. So at the end of the path of destruction is an end that is perfectly right for the path itself. Am I making sense? Does it make sense? Can you see it? Those on the path are living their lives in a way that suggests an inheritance that is in alignment with that life. You could say you reap what you sow. Add that to the peripheral vision. And then we have Paul, who he really gets after it here. I'm gonna read from you some excerpts from Romans chapter 1, where Paul really, in a sense, brings the inheritance of hell into clarity, okay? This is Romans 1, verses 18 and 19, and then I'll go to 21 and 22, and then I'll jump to 32. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. This is even referring back to the gospel. The good news was well known. It could be known. It could be understood. The story and the realities of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, and the price he paid, and the pathway that he created was known. God can be seen. Even beyond that, God can make himself known in the world that he created for humans to see. And Paul is saying, there is a choice, and it is made known. It is clear. You can see it. There is a godly pursuit, and then there is a wicked pursuit. But he goes on to say, for although they knew God, they didn't glorify him. They didn't make him center of all things, right? They didn't make him the one, nor did they give thanks to him. They didn't have any kind of relationship with him at all. They looked at their own life and took credit for what they had. It's a very self-oriented life. For although they knew God, they lived self-centered rather than God-centered. And listen to this, very powerful, very disconcerting series of dominoes here. And as a result, their thinking became futile. Their foolish hearts were darkened, and although they claimed to be wise, they became fools. That's how it goes. When you turn your back on God, you don't put him at the center of the universe, you don't put him high and lifted up, you don't turn to him for how to live, right? You turn to yourself or other things, your thinking goes bad. And when your thinking goes bad, your passions go sideways. And when your thinking and your passions go sideways, you start to convince yourself that you're smarter than everybody else, you're wiser, but you actually are a fool. And from that place of bad thinking, out of whack passions, and a denial that you're wise, life ends up looking a certain way, and Paul describes it. Just as they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, God gave them over to the depraved mind so that they do what they ought not be done. What ought not to be done? They become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They're full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. They're gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They have no understanding, no fidelity, no love, no mercy. Although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, in an eternal sense, right, and temporal, they not only continue to do these very things, but also approve of those who practice them. So what's Paul doing here? He's explaining the devastating and natural eventualities of those who turn away from God, choosing self over God as a priority, claiming credit for the rewards of life, even as it is deteriorating and being destructed, seeing it as wise and good all the while. Their thinking gets twisted. You can make this universal. This applies to every human being. This is the potential that we have, maybe the most natural potential that we have, that our thinking gets twisted. I know most of you in the room are believers, secure in your eternal future with God. But you can tell even in your own life when you forget who he is, where your trust is, when you fail to be obedient where he's instructed you to be obedient. Does not your mind start to wander? Does it not start to believe things that it wouldn't normally believe? Does it not start to be corrupted and darkened? And don't you begin to lose sight of God and lose confidence in God and lose faith in God? Yeah. And then what happens? Our passions that are good thinking and the grace and mercy of Jesus has pressed down in his side begins to bubble up and find new ways of expressing itself. Our passions get out of whack. And we don't notice it, right? We don't. But the saving grace of God, we all have been there. We go, oh my gosh, what is going on? Where? How did I get here? You know what it feels like to be wrong before you understand that you are wrong? Do you know what it feels like? Do you know what it feels like to be wrong? It feels exactly like being right. Until you are shown that it's wrong, being wrong feels exactly like being right. So the scary thing in life is when you feel like you're right. And that's the natural end of a destructive, hell-bound life. Hasn't gripped into the gospel and put faith in Jesus in a heaven-bound life. It is depraved of mind, of passion, and of understanding the foolishness of the self. And then in alignment with all of that comes this litany of predictable and destructive activities, capped off by this sickening depravity, right? Did you catch it at the end there where it says, let me read it exactly, although they didn't go to church, not only continue to do these very things, but also approve of those who practice them. How sick is that? You're spiraling down toward destruction, and others that are caught in this same spiral, you encourage them in that direction. Misery loves company. If I show you how you are wrong, I would have to admit how wrong I am. So I spur it on. Absolutely gross. Paul's sobering warning here describes the wrath of God as a dishonoring, ungrateful life, receiving and becoming precisely what it's pursuing. Tim Keller says this: the Bible tells us that people only get in the afterlife what they have most wanted, either to have God as Savior and Master or to be their own Saviors and Masters. C.S. Lewis said, in each of us there is something growing which will be hell unless it is nipped in the bud. Hell is therefore a prison in which the doors are first locked from the inside by us. So in our peripheral vision, we see two paths of people, heaven-bound, hell-bound. Heaven-bound, having understood and received the gospel and trusted by faith in Jesus, we're on this heaven-bound path. We also see Jesus weeping and waving and pointing at what's ahead on the hell-bound path. And now we see Paul assuring that God will not be mocked, how you will have chosen to be there in the end, with how you continue to live now. One of the scariest characteristics of those lost in this chosen trajectory of destruction is how in the end, they will pridefully choose to stay. It's too great of an admission at that point to say that I was wrong. And by then, the mind is completely gone. The passions are completely out of control. And the delusion is so great. There's this story in Luke chapter 16. It was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen, lived in luxury every day. I don't know what that means back then. Lots of money, the best foods, nice potato and leek soup. I don't know, whatever it is. He lived in luxury every day. At his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered with sores and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. And the time came when the beggar died, and the angel carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. In Hades, where he was in torment, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. So he called to him, Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue. Become I am in agony in this fire. It seems like a humble moment, but it's not. The dialogue goes on, but not once does this man call for him to be pulled from this place across the divide to that place. He never does it. He actually still sees Lazarus as a servant to him. Have Lazarus dip his finger in the cold water and send him over to hell to bring me a little bit of comfort. I'm staying here. In our peripheral vision, we add to the picture the arrogant, disobedient self-gratification of a life which can no longer see the truth and can't fathom suffering the humiliation of hearing about it. So there's two paths, two groups of people, gospel-oriented, faith, freedom, Jesus-loving, heaven-secured group of people, other group of people. Jesus is warning about what's coming, and we see them now on the path, becoming less and less aware of the wrong path that they are on, doing more and more, going deeper and deeper, and securing that eventual future. And at that point, only two views make sense for those on the hellbound path, and this applies to the life we live in. People in this life are on one of two paths. And those on the hellbound path, committed to it, only have one of two views of hell available for them: that it doesn't exist, or that it's not that bad. Right? What else can you conclude? Of course, those destined for hell would say there is no hell. There is no consequence if they think about it at all. Because, right, the other deception is that not only is there no hell or that it's not that bad, I'm actually on my way to heaven. 70% of people in America think they're on their way to heaven. Only 1% imagine them on their way to hell. It's a delusion, a very sad, destructive, horrific ending delusion. The last thing I wanted to share for you in your peripheral vision picture is life as a microcosm of eternity. And here's what I mean by it. The progression of bad decisions, poor choices, godless living, obedience to self rather than God, isn't, and a consequence for it, isn't foreign to us. It's logical, it's anticipated, it's experienced and enforced in this life as a microcosm of eternity. When a child touches a hot stove, it's hot and they get burned. No one's trying to come up with a non-hot burning stove, because if you don't have the burn, then you end up on fire. You've got to get your hand off of there. Consequences, we understand them, are good. You can run red lights to try to get there quicker. You're likely going to end one day in some sort of a tragic accident, even death, worse, of someone else. Failing to manage your budget, probably going to lead to debt, sometimes crushing debt, bankruptcy. If you betray one person or you're dishonest in a relationship, bonds will be broken and it'll lead to isolation. And we look at that and we go, yeah, of course. You can cheat on an exam and find some temporary success, but you're going to have to keep cheating. And eventually you're going to have a job in which you don't know what you're supposed to know, and you're going to lose your job. You can ignore medical advice and engage in unhealthy habits and that sort of thing, but you know what's going to happen. You're going to end up diseased or dead. And we look at that and we don't go, well, that shouldn't be. No, we don't. We like to say, I wish it didn't. I wish I could choose this way. and that wouldn't happen. But we don't say that. We go, yes, of course. If you have kids, you've heard it. You've told them 10 times, don't do that. Don't do that. This is going to happen. And then this happens and they go, why did this happen? Because that leads to that. That's the consequence. Corrupt business practices might make you early gains in the short term, but they lead to further cover-ups and career-ending repercussions. Okay, so these scenarios, they're tragic in many cases. They illustrate a fundamental truth about the human condition. We seek equilibrium and justice, echoing the larger divine balance promised by the existence of hell. These examples, these microcosms, these life situations reinforce the concept that our choices have far-reaching implications, in many cases beyond what we can see at the time. And that reality, the microcosm of life, extends into eternity. And maybe even more to the point, although we hope that the reap what you sow axiom is lenient upon me, right? That's what we hope. That's what we hope. I'm going to do this, and hopefully I won't get hurt too bad. Even though that's true, when it comes to others, we quite naturally and passionately demand consequences to wrongful, immoral actions. Because we know what the alternative creates. It doesn't create beauty. It creates devastation. It doesn't create cooperation. It creates relational deterioration. We understand for the world to be healthy, it has to operate according to God's ways, which include consequences and repercussions. So the final piece, which is better than any of the other pieces of our peripheral picture, is a God who is unabashedly God. A God who stoops to care and protect with great compassion, but who must also stand and ensure that all of creation expands precisely according to his design. Here's what our peripheral vision shows us. The gospel. Jesus provided freedom from the path of destruction to choose the heaven-bound path. Our peripheral vision shows us Jesus telling us the truth about hell. Our peripheral vision shows us that, like heaven, hell is an inheritance. God needn't send people to hell because he's designed the paths of life to absolutely find their logical end. We see in our peripheral vision that the consequence of hell demands self-examination. And we see the humble receiving it. And we see the hellbound not accepting it. They must deny hell's existence because it requires them to look at themselves. And we see a God who can be utterly counted on to perfectly exhibit all of his character in his dealings with humanity. What God makes true in creation is certainly true in eternity. It is illogical and self-serving to imagine that the God of the universe would operate within a framework of judgment and justice inferior to ours. And maybe these peripheral ideas are the better way to have a conversation about hell with somebody. Maybe you don't want to just set hell right up on there and say, hey, what about hell? You might want to ask questions like, can anyone be good enough to please God? How valuable is the practice of self-evaluation? Do you find things that delight you or scare you when you look in the mirror? Are consequences good? Should people get what they deserve? Why? What do undesirable consequences in our life say about God? Is Jesus trustworthy? Is it surprising that God and Jesus and the Bible would challenge humanity in uncomfortable ways? Those are good questions. Don't feel like you have to answer them. Let people answer difficult human questions. It's a good place to start. I want to add this one last thing, and then I'll let you guys play. You should start playing now, because it'll make it even better. I told you I'd end in a really positive space. The consequence of hell is a critical thing for the flourishing of those on the heaven-bound path. I'm going to say that again. That consequence of hell in life in general, not for the heaven-bound, but the consequence of it, the fact that it's there as a consequence, is a critical thing for the flourishing of those on the heaven-bound path. I just want to explain that. In a society that often views authority with skepticism, God's unchanging character, marked by perfect love and inflexible justice, offers believers an otherwise unattainable sense of security. I don't know if you can feel that. Just as a child feels a depth of security when their fathers are reliable and just in their discipline, so do we find comfort in God's predictable justice. Hell reassures us that there is an ultimate moral order. And just as a good father's presence claims and secures his children, so does the knowledge of hell and God's perfect authority. And it provides peace and confidence in this lifetime. Let me say it slightly different. Hell has work to do today in demanding humble self-examination and in reminding us of the perfect authority of God. And if we let it do its work in light of the gospel, there is nothing to fear. The reality of future hell as a part of the construct provides an unexpected, deep, surprising, and significant peace that allows for faithful, courageous flourishing today in the believer's life. Let me invite you to live there. God, it is weird to say that we're thankful for hell, but what we mean is we're thankful that you are just, that you are moral, that you are consistent in character, that we can count on you. God, is of deep, deep sadness to us, those in our lives that are on the wrong path. And it seems those times as there's so little we can do about it. God, would you allow us the privilege to maintain relationships with those people, and above all else, to be at peace, to be secure, to be courageous in Jesus. And God, would you send your Spirit in the midst of our obedience to soften hearts and open eyes of those that we love. Allow them the privilege of seeing where they're at and the privilege of seeing your pathway out. God, we trust you again and again and again, and we long for others to trust you as well. Amen.